Everybody ready? I think we might as well start. Could we start if everybody's settled? Could I just start by mentioning that this is the last lecture this term, but I'll be giving, I hope, four more lectures next term, making, I believe, 12 in total. That's what I was aiming for, anyway. Can I again thank everyone for coming? I'm really pleased to have given these lectures and very pleased to have such a continuous audience, so thanks very much. And I hope you still come back next term as well. I know next term is more occupied with exams, but I'll go on for at least the first four weeks, I think, next term. A lot of interesting stuff, I hope, I can assure you there. If you ask why the Soviet Union collapsed, if you ask why Marxism seems to have dissolved, if you ask why inequalities in the UK seem to be increasing, if you ask why there is a debate about family values of such intensity today, I can answer these questions in a word, and that word is globalization. Globalization is the topic of this lecture, and I want to use it to partly look back at what we've discussed so far, but also to introduce the topics of the succeeding four lectures. Now, term globalization, I think you'll agree, is everywhere now. You open any magazine, you know, you see a discussion of globalization. Open any newspaper, almost every day you see term globalization being mentioned. There is actually, I noticed, listening to radio this morning, a program about globalization on the radio tonight, I think Radio 4, around about 8 o'clock, I think an hour-long program on globalization. The term was almost nowhere 10 years ago. It was barely used 10 years ago, and now is everywhere. Now, this is both a sort of bonus and a problem, because although the term has become commonplace and even wearying, really, I don't think the notion is as yet well understood. And in this lecture, I want to try to puzzle through the concept of globalization and also begin to ask if globalization is indeed happening, what its consequences for us are. Along the way, I want to criticize quite a number of alternative viewpoints and positions. Now, when you begin to look at the current discussion on globalization, there already, within this short period, are different viewpoints about it, and this is a good place to start, I think. On the one hand, there are those who argue that globalization is both something quite new, or in large part new, that it is more or less total, that it is putting an end to many of the institutions with which we are familiar, including particularly the nation state, and that politics is coming to an end as global markets intensify and as we come to live, all of us, increasingly in a competitive global marketplace. This view you can call the view of the hyper-globalizers. These are writers who hold that the globalization process, if you like, is already almost complete, that as a result, many traditional institutions and structures, including not only the nation state, but also, for example, the welfare state, or much of the apparatus of leftist politics associated with the welfare state, are now dead, are inoperable in the new global world. Characteristic writer among the hyper-globalizers, one worth checking out because interesting, is, I just give an example, is Omai, Japanese author, who wrote two well-known books. One is called The Borderless World, and the other, surprise, surprise, is called The End of the Nation State. I think there are three books now called The End of the Nation State. you do realize the whole world is coming to an end, because almost every institution one can think of, someone has written a book saying it's come to an end. I mean, this is a culture of endings, whatever that means. Well, I'll discuss that in subsequent lecture, because it is, to me, a very interesting thing, really. The hyper-globalizers, views like Omis, tend to be represented, I think, in a particular literature above all. So literature mainly of business and managerial economics. This kind of viewpoint, the view that globalization has already swept most of the pre-existing institutions away, that we already live in a borderless economy, is not completely, but largely found in the writers of who appeal to a business community. And I think you have to see this type of literature as not only describing a particular view of the world, but also conveying a certain ideology of it. That because most of the writers in this type of viewpoint do tend to stress the positive advantages of globalization. They don't only see it as something sweet, being all before it and more or less complete, they see it as conferring economic benefits, and tend to stress those benefits rather more than they stress the limitations or problems of the phenomenon. So those are the hyper-globalizers. On the other side, you have completely opposite point of view, which is the view of people who've already come to be called the globalization skeptics. The globalization skeptics are a very sort of well-known type of person. They are the nothing is ever new under the sun type of author. That is, these are authors who say, we've seen it all before. These are authors who say that not only is there a certain ideological element in the writings of authors like Omid, these writers say it's all ideological. For them, talk of globalization is essentially the ideology of neoliberalism, the ideology of those who favor free market economy, excuse me, and who are using this ideology to institute that free market economy worldwide. But for the globalization skeptics, it has not produced the results claimed. The globalization skeptics argue that the level of globalization in the current period, the end of the 20th century, is no larger than it was at the end of the 19th century. They point to the fact that in the 19th century, there was a period when there was a strongly liberal trade regime, when there was an awful lot of international trade. People tend to forget this, but there was a period when not many people had passports. Passports were a relatively recent invention. They haven't been around nearly as long as most people think they have. This period, they say, was as highly globalized, if you look at the activities of the major corporations, for example, as our time is. They also say, if you look at the nature of world trade today, in some respects, world trade is more regionalized than it was 100 years ago. Because, for example, many of the trading blocs, like the European Union, basically trade with themselves. I think normally accepted that about 60% of trade within the European Union is products produced within the European Union, or services are sold within the European Union across that sector. This, they say, is therefore not globalization, really. You have a kind of series of regional trading blocks arising. So for them, globalization is essentially an ideological invention used to help attack the welfare state and attack the sort of consensual society which the globalization skeptics believe the welfare state was effectively used to achieve in the post-war period. Characteristic book, The Globalization Skeptics, is Paul Hurst and Paul Thompson. This is called Globalization in Question. For anyone who's interested in these issues, and there are reasons, as I mentioned in a moment, why I feel everybody should be, it's worth checking out these two sorts of alternative views of what's going on in the world, because you will see they are very radically different. Now, the globalization skeptics, unlike the hyper-globalizers, tend to be on the left, and they tend to argue, well, if globalization is a myth, if there's nothing much really that's happening that's very different from previous ages, well, we can go on with all the same old policies. So the people who take this position normally are interested in defending fairly traditional welfare state policies. They see the leftist project as still, to some degree, alive, and they believe that most of the things that politicians could do 30 or 40 years ago, they can still do. Very important which position you tend to take, because not only are they aligned to different political ideologies, they do make a tremendous difference to whatever you might decide is possible and necessary within the political sphere. As I would take it, there is a debate, for example, going on within the Labour Party between those you could roughly call the old left and the new Labour types. The old left are very happy with the finding that globalization is a myth, because then they simply say, well, we can just follow the same policies as we've always done and they can still be effective. If new Labour means anything, and I think it does mean something, it means acceptance that we do live in a different world and that new policies are necessary to try to adjust to and maximize the benefits from that world. Now, I'd suggest to you that each of these positions is mistaken and that one should adopt a different one from either of them, although incorporating elements of both. My view of globalization is that globalization, yes, in many respects is something very new, not just a continuation of previous ages. In this respect, the globalized, hyper-globalizers are correct. For me, for what it's worth anyway, my view is that globalization is the agenda now. It is not just an agenda among others. And I'll explain why I think that in a minute. I think that we are essentially the first generation struggling to live in a global age, as Martin Allbrown, sociologist, calls it, the new global age. We're struggling to live in a cosmopolitan global society whose parameters are indeed different from those with which most of us are familiar. However, contrary to the hyper-globalizers, I don't think globalization should be understood solely or perhaps even primarily as an economic phenomenon. It's not just about the globalization of economic markets, and I certainly don't think it's more or less completed as they do. On the contrary, I think we stand at the beginning of a process of intensifying globalization, not near the end, and we just don't know where it will lead us. It is part of the experimental nature of late modernity, which I discussed in an early lecture. We do not really know where this world we are creating will lead us. It is a risk-infused world, but it is something different, I think, from that of previous ages. Again, I'll explain why in a minute. My view is different from the globalization skeptics, precisely because I think globalization is something new, different, and radical, not just an extension of the past. I think they're right, however, to argue that globalizing processes don't necessarily destroy old institutions. On the contrary, to some degree, they strengthen them. If you consider the political sphere, in my view, it's not correct to say that intensifying globalization means the end of politics, whether this be defined as local politics, national politics, or supranational politics. On the contrary, I think in many respects, and these can be fairly easily identified, the advent of intensifying globalization makes politics more important rather than less, and makes the decisions which have to be taken more consequential rather than less consequential. In my view, I would put this bluntly, all politics is now about responses to globalization, but globalization is a complex phenomenon. It offers many possibilities as well as many limitations and difficulties. If you consider British politics, for example, I would say this theorem fits all the main decisions that have to be taken are in some sense responses to globalization, whether this be regional devolution and the question of Scottish independence, whether it be constitutional reform, whether it be European monetary economic integration, whether it be reforming the welfare state. All these are decisions which you can't escape. They're all very important and consequential decisions which the next government, whichever it is, will have to take or in some sense respond to. All of these can only be understood, I think, in a globalizing framework. They are all, in some sense, shaped by and demand responses to a world of intensifying globalization. Now, to pursue these themes, we have to work out what globalization actually is, how one should best conceptualize the term, and look at the complexities of what's going on in the world. Now, I'd like to suggest to you that the notion of globalization should not be understood to mean the development of an integrated world society. It does not mean that. On the contrary, again, globalization often means more fragmentation rather than more global unity. Globalization is not the same as simply the development of an overall system of any kind. In many respects, it carries the opposite connotation. Second, globalization is not, as I mentioned a bit earlier, purely an economic phenomenon, should not be just defined in terms of the accentuating importance of global economic markets, whether these be financial or industrial exchanges of goods. Third, globalization should not be seen, this is to my mind crucial, as just an out there phenomenon. Globalization should not be seen as just about the big systems, not just about systems or changes which are of a massive kind, which in some sense stretch across the world. That is not the way to look at it. Globalization, I want to argue to you, is as much an in-here phenomenon as an out-there phenomenon. Globalization is about a package of transformations which are unsettling local life, which are shaking up our local lives, which are shaking up ourselves, shaking up our relationship to our bodies, our emotions, to other people, just as much as they are transforming more hard-edged economic systems and larger structures and institutions across the world. Globalization is about intimacy, it's about personal life, it's about localities, it's about regions. It is not just about something which has to stretch all the way across the world in some sense. That's why, to me, it's irrelevant whether or not a large proportion of trade is carried on within the European Union. The European Union, to me, is an expression and a response to globalizing forces. Fourthly, we should recognize that globalization is a complex phenomenon. It's not just one dimension at all. It is several interacting dimensions which can move in different directions. Fifthly, we should recognize that globalization has opposite consequences in different parts of the world, in different time frames, and in different aspects of its consequences. To give you an example of that, why in many places do you find a return to local nationalism and an accentuation of local culture? Why has Scottish nationalism, for example, suddenly become all the more important? Why is Quebecois nationalism so important? What's happening in Catalonia? What's happening in Kashmir? All these changes, this accentuation of local cultural pride, have to be understood as responses to and involved with globalization. They are part and part of globalizing processes. they stand in some sense in opposition to them, but they are causally produced or brought about by them. There is therefore, if you like, a dialectic of globalization. What produces change in one aspect can produce counter change in another. We all know that different regions can prosper at the expense of other regions. We all know that what happens in the Far East with the miracle economies, for example, has consequences for the Western economies, but these are often quite opposing consequences. Globalization is like that. It's best to understand it dialectically as producing opposing or contradictory consequences in different parts of the world and in different contexts of life, if you like. Now, these things having been said, how then best to define it? I propose to you the best way to define globalization is in terms of what I call action at distance. Globalization refers to the increasing intensity of action at distance in our lives. Distant events influence even intimacies of our personal life much more directly, much more completely, and much more closely than they ever did before. And in turn, lifestyle decisions which we take have planetary or global consequences to a much greater degree than was ever true for previous generations. Globalization, if I can put it this way, is about the transformation of time and space. It's about the transformation of time and space. It therefore refers to a different way of life, I think, from that which has dominated until relatively recently. That's why I think among the influences promoting globalization, and there are many such influences, there is, I think, above all, the unleashed effect of global capitalism, of course, following the collapse of the Soviet Union. No one is outside any longer. Of course, there is that. But that, in turn, was made possible by a convergence of a series of revolutions, some of which are technological revolutions. I think just as important as anything economic is the invention of satellite communications, instantaneous electronic communication, and the convergence of these with computer technologies over the past 20 or 30 years. This kind of integration of new forms of global communication with computer technology is something new, I think. It means that it not only we live our lives differently, because in an electronic culture, I mean, it's plain that our lives resonate to different images. It's plain that some of us live electronic lives, as it were, whereas previously we might have lived more directly integrated local lives. Just witness the influence of soap opera as an example of that. Soap opera is usually electronically conveyed narrative image of neighborliness or an image of life which has enormous appeal and hold over people. It expresses something about how one lives in the world. It is not just a form of entertainment. It in some part constitutes how people see the world. This is what it's like to live in a global electronic culture, I think. In a global electronic culture, instantaneous communication transforms the nature of what community is. It means you can keep in touch with people, of course, more or less across indefinite distances. But it does also create new institutions. In the very first lecture, I remember mentioning one of these, particularly important, I think, the creation of 24-hour global money markets. 24-hour global money markets are, of course, part of the new intensifying global economy, but they have only been possible because of the marriage of satellites, computers, electronic communication, which I mentioned earlier. The city, the city of London, has become transformed because of this. The city is part of an electronic network of globalized information money. Now, there are some authors, including some I want to discuss in the next lectures, who have argued, as a recent interesting book called The High Risk Society, for example, just in the process of reading, because I only just arrived this morning, but it's pretty interesting, that the high risk society, this book argues that financial markets and particularly global money markets are becoming the sort of exemplar of all forms of economic and indeed social exchange. High-risk society is one where you must make many risky decisions if you are to prosper. I think this is true. It's true of marriage as much as it's true, however, of economic investment decisions. What it's like to live in a risk society, we'll talk about next term. It's something that I think is absolutely crucial to thinking about how we live now. Every sexual contact you make, for example, involves, of course, the possibility of death. This was always true, but now we think about it in a new information environment. Now, I think this is materially true because of the rise of AIDS. This is, in fact, the case, except we think of it now in these terms, or it cannot but enter your consciousness in some sense. It's true of a world where you must take many more decisions, more directly and more consciously than ever before, I think. This is one of the changes which, whatever you want to call it, a global age or a high-risk society brings into being. So globalization for me is not simply one agenda among others. It's not simply one chapter in a textbook among other chapters. It's not simply a kind of ring fence perimeter external to our lives. Globalization is increasingly becoming how we live. If you understand by globalization a transformed world in which the relationship between the local and the global, and even the personal and the planetary, has shifted beyond, I think, almost all recognition over a period of some 30 or 40 years. This means, I think anyway, and I stress this is my views and suggesting controversial views, I think, that therefore the last 30 or 40 years, which I take to be the period during which globalization has intensified, are not just a continuation of the characteristic tendency of Western capitalism to expand across the world. Now, we saw Marx and Weber had somewhat different views, but quite powerful views of why Western capitalism has come to expand, why it is a world-corroding civilization, which indeed it is. Marx, I think, provided an explanation of the endless tendency of a market society to expand, which probably still holds good. As I mentioned when discussing Marx, this is not a society which can stand still. It cannot stand still. It cannot live by standing still. Therefore, there's always been an expansionary quality to Western capitalism. We all know this. It took in some part the form of colonialism in earlier generations. When colonialism collapsed or was contested, took the form of various forms of neocolonialism. Some of those forms of neocolonialism are plainly still alive. You only have to think of the domination of the world's media systems by Western corporations to see that neocolonialism, if you define it in this way, has not disappeared. However, I think the last 30 or 40 years, substantially but certainly not wholly because of the influence of satellite instantaneous communication, the last 30 or 40 years are a period of much more decentered globalization. This is a crucial difference. Decentered globalization is intensifying global influences of the kind conceptualized in the way in which I suggested earlier. It's decentered globalization in the sense in which there is no part of the world which is any longer easily able to impose its will over other parts of the world. Of course, the richer countries can do so in a transitory way. And we saw this in the case of the Gulf War, for example, the extraordinary military power of the United States and its allies in that war. But this is very far from being a continuing position of hegemonic domination. Rather, decentered globalization creates what in an earlier lecture I called a runaway world, that is, it's a world where many aspects of our lives are influenced by uncertainties or issues which no one any longer fully controls. The difference from the past is that these aspects of our lives, which no one any longer fully controls, do not come from unconstituted nature, do not come from unconstituted tradition. They come from the transformation of nature and tradition. We live in a world, as I'll be trying to analyze in subsequent lectures, where nature and tradition no longer have the hold which they used to do on our behavior. Most of the things which we couldn't master in the past came from nature, or came from, as Marx said, a failure to understand our own history. This is no longer the case. Most of the difficulties we face now are those to do with our very mastery of nature, or attempts at mastery of nature, and our attempts at mastery of ourselves. That's the twist of the Enlightenment theorem that I mentioned before, and which I'll come back to again because it has very profound consequences. A consequence of decentered globalization is partly in the first world countries. You see many phenomena appearing which in previous eras, rightly or wrongly, were simply supposed to be, quote, third world, quote, phenomena, such as people begging on the streets, such as radical differences between rich and poor, such as very high levels of unemployment, and so forth. There is no society in the first world which has not contained third world type pockets, if you want to put it that way. And there are very few societies in the, quote, third world, unquote, which don't contain pretty highly developed first world sectors as well. This division, as we all know, is one among many other things which seem to have come to an end. People have written books called The End of the Third World, and in this they are correct. With the end of the third world, the end of the second world, you of course have the end of the first world. The first world is no longer distinctive in a world of decentered globalization. This is a world, really, I would say, with characterized at the moment by two different processes of modernization. On the one hand, there's what I called earlier in a previous lecture, simple modernization, characteristic of the Asian economies, the rush to growth, if you like. This is probably plateauing out. In the West, you have essentially what I called reflexive modernization or second phase modernization, which is modernization coming to grapple more and more with the problems which it itself has created. Modernization grappling with its problems, modernization grappling with its limits, this will be the history of the 21st century, or at least the first decades of the 21st century, and I have to say quite a lot more about it. Now, the emergence of a world of intensifying decentered globalization generates, there's no doubt about it, many opportunities for us. I think there's no doubt about it that these changes do have many positive benefits. These seem to include the possibility of the creation of enormous wealth. We don't know where the end of that process is. They seem to include emancipation, individual freedom in many directions, not just in Western countries but across the world. But they also involve very difficult and perturbing problems. Just the kind of problems which Marx suggested we would be facing, but which Marx's solutions to have collapsed. Let's look at these problems in a bit more detail because they're a very useful way of structuring the next band of lectures. You can say that from the early years of the globalizing tendencies of modernity, that is from the 17th century onwards essentially in Europe, there have been at least four main dimensions of globalizing processes. There are others that you could distinguish, but these I think are particularly important. First, you had the development of what Wallerstein calls world capitalist economy. I'll just flesh in these a bit more in a minute. Second, you have what you could call international division of labor. Third, you have global nation state system. And fourth, you have a global military order. You could add other dimensions like the cultural dimension, but I shan't discuss that here. These are at least four principal dimensions of modernity, and therefore of the globalizing tendencies of modernity since its beginning. In our period, the period of decentered globalization, the period of intensifying, transformed globalization, something is happening along each of these dimensions. Along each of these dimensions, big transformations are occurring, and all of them, on each of these four, are both creating tremendous opportunities, as I mentioned, but also equally tremendous problems. Since it's nice to be a bit cautionary, let me, for the moment, concentrate on the problems to conclude off this band of lectures. The world capitalist economy refers to, essentially, globalized capitalistic markets involving the exchange of goods and services on at least the large scale. I think it's important to stress again that when you talk of world capitalist economy or a global capitalist economy, it doesn't have to be in a blunt sense wholly global. Every transaction doesn't have to carry the whole world, to cover the whole world. A global capitalist economy is a capitalist economy which is becoming largely dislocated from the older constraints of time and space. So it's much more mobile, flexible, instantaneous than it used to be. These qualities can be used to regionalize production and exchange just as much can be used to stretch them right across the world. So as it were, in the current period, a new intensifying of what was always there. Now, the world capitalist economy seems to be associated with a global tendency towards polarization of rich and poor. I have to say, in much the way in which Marx anticipated or seems to have thought it would do. Socialism, it seems fairly clear, is not a great wealth-producing engine. Capitalism is. It's through the expansion of capitalism that the Asian economies have become rich in such a way as to rival the West. It's through the expansion of capitalism that Latin America, Central America, seems to be taking off economically, in some respects at least. It's through capitalism, it seems, that India is increasingly mobilizing itself for a process of economic development. Capitalism generates wealth, no doubt about it. It doesn't seem to be able to create a system which makes that wealth production equitable. Capitalism seems to produce wealth, but at the same time it produces poverty, or at least it produces a yawning gap between the haves and the have-nots. Socialism was supposed to resolve this problem. At the moment, I think we have to say we do not know clearly in the world how to resolve it, except we must see it as a fundamental problem. It is a problem, as everyone sitting here will know, of the rich and poor nations. It is a problem, for example, of large parts of Africa seeing an absolute reduction in levels of wealth over the last 10 to 15 years, whereas other parts of the world have seen an acceleration in the wealth accumulation process. I don't want to say these two things are in any simple sense causally related. There are great complexities in explaining, for example, why the African continent, or much of it, seems, as it were, to have been left out of the rush to growth, which many of the rest of the world are involved in. Nevertheless, the more you allow free markets to have their play, the more it seems you tend to get economic inequality. What applies on a world scale is now applying within the industrialized countries, within Britain, but in most industrialized countries too. There seem to be clear tendencies towards increasing polarization between rich and poor. This polarization, you know, could crudely, but could be described in the way in which some recent writers have described it, as a kind of polarization between a global overclass on the one hand and a global underclass on the other, at least at the two extremes. You have a global, big global middle class in between. global overclass, and I think it's much too crude a characterization, but it's a useful sort of marker. Global overclass consists of people who are cosmopolitan, who themselves travel a lot, who use the new technologies, and perhaps use the new technologies very intensively, particularly the marriage between computer and communications technology, who never have enough time because they work all the time. They work in a kind of macho working culture across the world in which you cannot work too hard. At the other end, you have people who have too much time and not enough work to find an identity or sufficient material resources to sustain their lives. I think at the moment we can't be completely sure how far this is the result of capitalism, but it seems to be linked to the freeing of capitalistic market forces. Now, in the period of intensifying globalization, what's happened to this, I would say, is partly a tremendous speed up of global economic exchanges, which the new technologies make possible, but also partly simply the fact that no one is outside. There's no one any longer, maybe apart from a few individuals in isolated communes, outside of the world capitalist economy. While the Soviet Union existed, while China was still doctrinally communist, while the Eastern European countries existed, there were regions of the world outside, but no one is outside any longer. Second, by the international division of labor, I mean the spread of the large corporations around the world and the division of labor they create between production and consumption in different regions. What's happening here in the period of decentered, intensified globalization is a tremendous acceleration in the degree to which the corporations are using sources of finance and labor power very distant from the places where they have their headquarters. We all know and have read about, I'm sure, examples of this. Swiss Air, for example, has many of its ticketing operations in Delhi, and it makes apparently not much difference to, or actually expands the effectiveness of their ticketing operation. The international division of labor means essentially the spread of industrial production worldwide, and it creates enormous problems. Among these problems are the problems of environmental degradation, which, so far as all the evidence indicates, is still accelerating. Environmental degradation is bound up with the spread of industrial technologies fostered worldwide by the expansion of manufacturing production and other technologies of production, which the large corporations routinely export now across the world, almost everywhere. The looming problem here, again, as I take it, most people very familiar, is what happens when the less developed countries of the world themselves pursue a course of economic development. The world does not seem able to contain ecologically another global process of intensified economic development or industrialization. A world which is globally industrialized at the moment does not seem ecologically possible, although even that is more controversial than one might imagine. Global nation-state system, well, we all know something's happening here with the publication of books like The End of the Nation-State. In a period of intensified globalization, the nation-state no longer has the role it used to do. This does not mean, I think, that it loses its power. It means that different powers come back to the nation-state from those that existed previously, and different political decisions have to be taken from those which were dominant previously. These political decisions, as I mentioned earlier, are no less consequential for all that. In some ways, they're more consequential and more urgent because you must respond to globalizing forces. You cannot stand outside. That's why political decisions in some respects become more urgent, more important, and more difficult, though, at the same time than ever before. In terms of the global problems created by expanding expansion of the nation state at the same time simultaneous part or transformation of the nation state, many problems of human rights, I think, especially whether or not we can make human rights legislation count in international law are crucial here. States often oppress people. Oppression can also come about, however, through the collapse or transformation of pre-existing nation states. We have no global system of governments which at the moment seems effectively able to cope with the problems to which this gives rise. In the case of the global military order, you have also major transformations happening. Until relatively recently, global military order was essentially a bipolar standoff formed around the arms race. Whatever you think of that system, it was clearly to some degree a stabilizing the Cold War period was not a happy period. It was a period when the world could literally destroy itself, but nevertheless there was a sort of stability in it, as we see retrospectively. The most difficult issue, I think, in respect of the world military order in the period of decentered globalization or post-1989 globalization is the issue of nuclear proliferation. How, if at all, we can contain the spread of nuclear weapons around the world. We know the spread of nuclear expertise is happening. We know, for example, that many top-class nuclear scientists from the ex-Soviet Union are now working in countries, probably on military projects. We know that probably about 100 countries in the world could, within the next 10 years, have the capability for building nuclear weapons. At least this has been speculated. We don't know at the moment how far such proliferation can be controlled. Therefore, some writers in international relations, I think, at least quite rightly pose the question whether the world is actually safer militarily than it was before or not. I think that, as many of these issues, that really comes down to a question of risk. I mean, the risks which were run before were much greater in terms of their implications for humanity, but the level of risk of at least some kind of nuclear confrontation is possibly much higher now than it was in the Cold War period. If you tie all these things together, you have a kind of framework for analyzing both the problems and the possibilities of the late 20th century world. All of this, however, is only one dimension of globalization. All of this refers to what I would call the external or institutional frameworks of globalization. Just as important, just as pressing, and for most of us in many ways with more ramifications for who we are and what we do, is the intrusive influence of globalization into everyday life. You have tremendous number of transformations occurring on these institutional dimensions. You have equally deep transformations affecting personal life, affecting marriage, affecting the family, affecting the emotions, affecting the relationship between the sexes. These are just as crucial a part of globalization as the big systems are. I'd like to leave you with this thought because it's very important for what I'd like to discuss next term. Globalization expresses itself in the transformation of everyday life. As it does so, it's not just a matter of the external academic observer taking an interest in it. All of us are struggling with problems of identity. All of us are struggling with problems of defining our relationship to our bodies, to our appearance, to who we are, to our identity. All of us are struggling with problems about what marriage means, about what it should mean, about what our relationship to our children should be. Globalization, for better or for worse, is like a can opener. It opens up all these issues. It opens them up partly in an emancipatory way, but as in the case of global institutions themselves, it also creates many problems and anxieties for us, and it's these that I'll focus on next term. Thanks very much for coming this term anyway.